COC, how's it going today? You guys doing all right? Yeah? Awesome. Glad to have you here, finishing up a series that we've been doing for the last 6 weeks called My Family Circus, and we enter into the last week that we've called the Echo. That's what we've called it today. If you haven't been here for the last few weeks, obviously we've been talking about family in particular. Have you enjoyed this series? Some of you, think about it, wait until after today, give me your feedback, all right, I appreciate it. One last time, want to plug a couple extra resources in addition to what we've been talking about here and in the Word of God, a couple books that we've got available outside at the Care Ministries table, Parenting Isn't for Cowards by Dr. Dobson and Boundaries with Kids by Dr. Henry Cloud. Want to encourage you to grab those. This will be the last week that you can probably grab one of those. And then also, if you haven't been here and you would like to catch up on this series, we have it available on our podcast and videocast at churchcelebration.com, so you're welcome to go there as well. As we wrap up this series today, I kind of want to stretch our brains a little bit as we have a conversation. When we think about family in Western culture, we're a little bit limited in how we think about family. So basically what that means is if I were to ask you about your family, you would probably tell me about your immediate family, your wife, your kids, and basically that would be the case. But if in most of the world, if you were to ask them about their family, they would go farther back into a deeper heritage of their family. They would probably start with a great-great-great-grandfather and then move to a great-great-grandfather and then a great-grandfather and then their grandfather. And by the time they reached them or their father, it was like five different generations that they were talking about. And this is kind of the way the world thinks, and we're a little bit different. We're a little bit more westernized, and we don't always think this way. We think a little bit more about the here and the now. But here's what I'm after today. Regardless of what or how you think, you are who you are immediately because of your parents, and your parents are who they are because of their parents, which would be your grandparents, and so on. It's passed down. My point is primarily this, if you're a note taker, I think this is the first one. We are who we are because of the people who came along before us. We are. We just simply are. And whether we're being intentional about this or not, here's the reality. You are responsible of playing a part of shaping, of cultivating the next generation of your family by what you say and what you do. You just are. And you are going to be a part of someone's life, a future generation. And the decisions that you are making or make right now, or what you do right now, is going to impact. It is going to impact someone else's future life. It just is. It just is. So, for example, I firmly believe personally that I am in ministry today because of a rich godly heritage on my mom's side and my grandfather's life. His name was Lauren Abel, and he was a farmer, an Iowa farmer, and he literally is one of my spiritual heroes. He just is. And my grandfather, though he was a farmer, he was a godly, godly man, and he knew this Bible better than probably anybody that I have ever met in my life. He came from a family full of missionaries, full of full-time ministry workers, and I believe I am where I am today because of the great influential life that he lived. I am who I am today because of him. In addition to that, I'll share a quick story with you about my grandfather's heritage so you understand a little bit about who he was. You may often wonder why I'm so big and why I talk a lot about generosity in general and how we are to give of our time, our talents, and our treasures. Why do we do that all the time at COC? Well, you can blame my grandpa for that if you want. Because my grandfather, first of all, let me backtrack. Not only do I think in my studies in 20 years of ministry that money is a very big deal to God. And not only do I think it's probably one of the top three most spiritual topics, and we can debate on that, and I'll tell you where, and I'll point to like basically the entire New Testament and where Jesus spoke more about money than he did about heaven and hell, and prove to you that it is a big spiritual issue. But I also am this way because my grandfather practiced it in such a way. He just did. My grandfather, see, he desired greatly to be in full-time vocational ministry. It was a passion of his, but the opportunity never made itself really available to him. And as I just said, he was an Iowa farmer, and he prayed for God to allow him the opportunity to be in full-time vocational ministry. But God had other plans for him, and God's plan for my grandpa was simply this: not to be in full-time ministry, but to be a staunch supporter of it with his treasures, a staunch supporter. And this was his legacy. My grandfather was known to be unbelievably generous. He gave so far, guys, so far above and beyond the normal person and the normal follower of Jesus, it would blow your mind. It's been told to me that my grandfather lived most of his life giving to the church, to missionaries, to full-time ministry, over 70% of his income. This is the life of my grandfather. And I believe this is why I'm such a firm believer in giving. It's greatly influenced who I am, where I am today, and why I communicate about it so passionately and so frequently and fervently. And it's because of this, is I've witnessed with my own eyes the impact that his generosity has had nationally and internationally for the cause of Christ. So my grandfather's legacy has been spoken into my life. And my point is today, is you are who you are today because of the people who came before you. And the family who comes after you will become the people they become in large part based on your influence on them today. And I want you to let that one sink in. That one needs to really go down deep and take root in your heart and your soul today, because that's the premise of our entire conversation of what we're going to be discussing. All right, now, as I said at the beginning of this series, and you've heard, there just aren't very many great biblical family examples in the Bible. That's why whenever I will come up to somebody and they might say something like this, is, I want to have a biblical family, I kind of cringe a little bit. And I'm like, okay, do you want to share with me the example of the family in the Bible that you would like to have? Because there's just not that many great biblical family examples. But there is one story in particular that does a great job at demonstrating the power of this generational parenting idea that is our theme for today. And what's unique about this story is it's about 60 years in the making. And there's a lot of messed up, just jacked up stuff in it for sure. But what happens in the end, the redemptive ending, it just really does a great job at showing us the power that generational, godly generational parenting holds, that supports our shaping the future idea today. So today I want to kind of basically narrate this for you, because we're literally going to be in about, 13 different chapters in telling this story. And I kind of want to do my very best at narrating it for you. And then I want to tell you the part that maybe you, and I mean, when you hear the first part of the story, you're going to be like, I know this story, I've heard it before, and that's cool, just walk with us. But I'm going to share with you a part that I don't know that maybe you have ever connected the dots with, and bring that out for you. So basically, here's how it goes. It's in Genesis, and we're going to read some passages of Scripture along the way. But here's basically how it starts off, all right? The story begins with a family that many of you have probably heard of, with a guy named Abraham. Raise your hand if you've heard of the guy named Abraham, right? You've probably, if you've been in church at all, you've heard that. You've probably sung that, Father Abraham had many sons, you know, and the song that just never freaking ends, right? Yeah. Now, Abraham has a son, the promised son to him, and we know kind of a little bit about that story, and his name is Isaac. And then Isaac has two sons himself, and their names are Esau and Jacob. But if you grew up in church, you probably heard it the other way around. You heard it Jacob and Esau. But the reality is that you can go check factually, it's true. It was actually Esau and Jacob because they were twins, and Esau was born before Jacob. And as you've probably heard me teach before about the older son, and that's why I draw this out, is this. The older son in that day and age would receive huge privileges. If you were the older son or the firstborn, if you were Esau in this particular case, it meant that upon your father's death, you would receive double share of the estate one day. It would be yours to come. And it also meant that one day you would eventually become the judge. You would assume the top spot in your line, in your family's life. You would become the central authority, and you would then become the new patriarch of the family when your father died. So this was a big deal, and this is why I highlight this and say it's actually Esau and Jacob, and we'll make sense of it here in a minute. But Jacob, all right, let's talk about him for a minute. Jacob has 12 sons. And they later become known in the Old Testament as the 12 tribes of Israel. And if you grew up in church, you probably know the most famous son of Jacob. And I'm going to do a big Bible quiz right now. And if you don't know the answer, don't scream out Jesus, because it's not always the answer in church. But I'm going to just do a big Bible quiz right now. Who was Jacob's most famous son? Oh, good job, people. Give yourselves a round of applause. That's awesome. Some of you are like, yeah, that's okay. Joseph. Joseph. Now, you know about Joseph. He's the kid with the coat of many colors. He's his dad's favorite kid. His brothers hate him. They try to sell him, or they sell him into slavery. He's a dreamer, and on goes the list, and that's kind of what we're going to narrate today and bring out some of these ideas. And that's a story that many of us have heard. Now, today, I'm going to briefly narrate this for you and walk you through a little bit of the life of Joseph. Okay, but I want you to just look ahead a little bit. What's exciting is we're going to do a series this fall called What to Do When You Don't Know What to Do. And we're going to actually look at the life of Joseph a little bit more. So this is maybe just a little bit of a prequel. You know what I'm saying? I know prequels aren't always as good as the real deal, like Star Wars. Those things just fell right on their face, right? And The Hobbit's not really as good as The Lord of the Rings. So hopefully today's prequel won't fall on its face. But let me walk you through it. Joseph is the 11th son of Jacob. He's the 11th son of Jacob. And all of his brothers grow up hating Joseph. And here's why they hated him. And this is another idea, once again, about this biblical family problem in the Bible. Just not a great narrative. There's deception. There's trickery. We'll talk more about it here in a minute. But this is crazy. This is dysfunctional in the family. You got 10 brothers that hate their baby brother. And some of you are like, that's not that dysfunctional. I hate my baby brother, you know, but you're dysfunctional then. You're not supposed to hate. But they hate Joseph because Joseph, and then our 12th little guy is named Benji. We won't talk that much about him, but his name is Benjamin. But Joseph and his little brother, the 12th, Benjamin, they're the last of the 12 boys. And here's what's unique about these two guys, and here's why these other 10 guys hate them, is they have a different baby mama. They have a different baby mama. The other 10 boys have different mamas altogether, but Joseph and Benji's mama, her name is Rachel. Her name is Rachel. And it's worth noting that Rachel was the favorite wife of Jacob. Who here has a favorite wife today? I hope every man is raising their hand today. Is my wife in here? No, she's not. What's up, giving? Oh, there she is. Hey, babe. You're my favorite wife. Rachel is Jacob's favorite wife, their daddy. He's the daddy of all 12, but they all got different baby mamas. So he shows great favor to Rachel, because that's his favorite wife. And again, this is customary. This is in that day and age. This was practiced often. Don't think this is whacked out, weird cultist stuff, okay? So in addition to treating his favorite wife great, he treated his two favorite boys, Benjamin and Joseph, great. That's a whole nother story. But here's what happened in short of why this was the case. Jacob, back to daddy of Joseph, Jacob worked 7 years for his father-in-law, Laban, for the hand of Rachel, which was the oldest daughter of Laban. But on the night that he worked, after 7 years, on the wedding night that he was going to marry his favorite wife, the woman of his dreams, all right, Laban deceives him. He tricks him and sends in the youngest daughter, Leah, which means cow. Why would you name your daughter cow? I don't know. But he sends in, Leah says, in our culture, in our custom, you marry the youngest daughter first. It's not the case. Laban's just basically trying to get some free service and free work from, and free labor from his future son-in-law. So he tricks him. So he's like, but if you want to marry Rachel, you got to work another 7 years for me. Do you see how there's no great biblical story about family in the Bible? This is just jacked up stuff. So he ends up working another 7 years, gets Rachel's hand in marriage, the originally intended wife. So Joseph then was the son of Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel, and so was Benji. They were highly favored from their daddy. So naturally, guys, you can think about this. Naturally, this made the other 10 boys extremely, extremely jealous. They had different mamas. They were treated differently. Joseph gets his coat from Saks Fifth Avenue. The other boys have to go to the thrift store to get their clothes. This is just not going well. So they hate Joseph. Story goes on. The older 10 brothers see Joseph coming one day because daddy says, go check on the boys because I don't trust those boys. Out in the fields, and Joseph goes out, and he tries to check up on them, and they see him coming. Now, I'm skipping a lot of stuff that we'll kind of draw out in our future series, but Joseph is a dreamer, and he's had dreams before that all these brothers are going to bow down to him, and he boasts this out, and they don't really like that either. So they're like, look, here comes the dreamer. I got an idea. Let's kill him. Once again, phenomenal biblical family story. If you have ever thought about killing a sibling, you need serious help today, people. Care Ministries, you've got to set up a counseling appointment. All right, but this is what's kind of going on. Let's kill our brother. Big brother, one of the big brothers steps in and says, let's not do that. I believe it's Reuben. And he says, let's not do that, but let's throw him in the bottom of a pit and let's teach him a lesson. I don't know where Reuben disappears to, but later on, they do decide to throw him in a pit. Reuben's not around, and Judah decides, hey, listen, why do we need to kill this guy when we can make some money off of him? See that traveling caravan of Ishmaelites coming over the side of the hill? Let's sell him into slavery. Then we'll take his coat, and we'll rip it to shreds, put some blood on it, and we'll go back and tell Dad that he was killed by a wild animal. And then in the Bible, if you read this story, Reuben shows back up later, and he's already sold into slavery. And he's like, where's our brother? And he's like, well, we sold him. We got some cash. Here's your pot. Right here is your portion. You know? So these guys are just not in a good deal. So they enslave their brother. They enslave him. And basically, they go back to break their father, Jacob's, heart and tell him about his favorite son that he's been killed. And meanwhile, Joseph is being dragged off, tied up behind some camel on his way to Egypt for a lifetime of slavery. But here's what happened. Not only was he a slave once, he became a slave twice. Upon his arrival in Egypt, he was sold once again into the home of Potiphar. Now, let me call time out here just for a second. Something that's interesting so far in, are you tracking with me? Can I just get some head nods? Okay, here's something interesting about Joseph right now in our story. In the midst of all this tragedy so far, while Joseph is in Potiphar's house in slavery for the second time, Joseph decides that he was just going to do this. No matter what comes my way, I'm just going to live a life. I'm going to live a life like God is with me, even though everything so far in his life had appeared like God had abandoned him. He just said, but no matter what comes my way, I'm going to live a life as if God is with me, even though it looks like he has abandoned me. It's just an interesting perspective. And if you read the story in its entirety, it appears that every time and every turn in Joseph's life, Joseph does the right thing, even though the right things never seem to happen. So let's keep walking. Let's keep walking. The Bible tells us that Joseph gains big, significant favor in Potiphar's house with Potiphar. Potiphar raises him up and says, everything in this house is under your charge, and I'm the only one over you. So Potiphar recognizes that God's blessing him. This guy, he's like, so I'm going to bless you too. And he raises this slave to be number two in the house. And he gains great favor with Potiphar. But apparently he gained great favor in a lustful way with Potiphar's wife named Potiphar. And you've heard me say this before. We don't know her name, but I'm just going with Potiphar because it works well with this story. I don't know. So she seduces Joseph one day. He refuses based on his faithfulness to his master, first and foremost, Potiphar, and then ultimately because I'm going to be faithful. Even though God doesn't appear to be with me, he seems to have abandoned me. I'm going to be faithful to God, and this is wrong. And he has this moral compass with God that is right, it's true, it's holy. And basically when she seduces him, he bolts, he takes off. She's got a hold of him, the Bible says. And he's like stripping his clothes off, running out the house. She holds on to his cloak and basically runs for his life saying this isn't right. But now he's kind of left evidence with her. So basically she's ticked off. Potiphar, you don't want to make a Potiphar mad. And basically she cries rape and says, look, this Jewish boy, this Hebrew boy that you brought in our house has come in to make sport of me, and he tried to rape me, and he took off. And of course, Potiphar knows you got to side with Potiphar, right? You got to side with your wife. So he finds Joseph, and now he throws him in prison. Now, guys, you need to kind of let this one sink in for a little bit, okay? Prison, I don't know if I've ever met anybody that says, I want to grow up and I want to go to prison. That's just my life goal. Prison is not a place that you ever want to be. Can I get an amen? Amen. Yeah, for sure. But it's definitely not a place that you want to be if you're a slave. Because it's like, no, it's not just like prison for you. It's like a place, the lowest of low places. It's like you get thrown into a place that you are waiting and waiting and waiting for nothing. I mean, right now, Joseph's thinking, this is my life. This is what it's going to be. It's not looking good. And I'm going to be here forever. And then we run into this verse that sort of summarizes Joseph's situation up to this point in life. This is right after the Potiphar incident, and he's now a slave in prison. And this is the verse, Genesis 39, 21. The Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. And at this moment in time, we're like, yes, way to go, Joseph. You gained favor in the eyes of your master Potiphar. You were raised here. Now you have gained favor in the eyes of the prison warden. Your future is about to change. And I'm sitting here thinking, really? What? Is that where you want to be? I mean, in prison as a slave and be gained favor? It's still not looking good. And my question right here is, this is why? Why does Joseph live a life that seems like God is with him? Even though by all circumstances and all appearances, it appears that God has abandoned him. I come to this point of the story and I just don't understand this. I want to know, where did this mindset come in for Joseph? Where did this kind of faith resonate inside this young man that no matter what came his way, he was going to stand his ground and he was not going to back down and he was going to live as if God was with him, even though it had appeared that God had abandoned him? I just find it curious, and I thought you might find it interesting as well. So let's keep walking. Some time goes on. He's got some favor in two places. Cool, he's still in prison. Joseph's in prison. You might know the story. The Pharaoh, who is the man, viewed as the god of the world at that time, His cupbearer and his baker make him mad. I don't know what you have to do to make the king or the Pharaoh mad as a cupbearer. You know what I'm saying? And I don't know what this is, or the baker. So this guy is large and in charge, and he does whatever he wants, and he throws his cupbearer and baker into the prison. And basically, because Joseph is the top guy, the prison warden raised him up to this level of command, he puts them underneath Joseph's care. And one night, they both have dreams. And since Joseph was a dream weaver, you know what I'm talking about, he basically interprets their dreams because they're just in a dilemma. And it's one good interpretation for the cupbearer. It's like, dude, this is what's going on. 3 days, you're getting released. You're going to be restored to your position. Way to go, bro. And then with the baker, it's like, oh, that's good news. What about mine? He's like, ah, not so good news. In 3 days, you're getting out, but your life's over. You know, you're going to get hung. Rock? You know, give me some. It's all right. And this is kind of what happens. And basically all that Joseph asks at this point in time, because all hope seems to be lost, is he says, hey, cupbearer, when you get out, would you just do me a favor? Would you please tell somebody I'm in here? Nobody has a clue that I am in here. I mean, I don't want to bore you with all the injustices, but this is where I'm at. I shouldn't be here. Please tell somebody I'm in here. Cupbearer gets released 3 days later, just like he foretold. And guess what? He forgets about Joseph. He forgets about him for like 2 more years. Man. Now let's keep walking. 2 years later, Pharaoh has a dream, deeply disturbed by it, and can't find anybody to interpret it. And then finally, the cupbearer finally remembers, oh my gosh, oh yeah, I remember there was a little Hebrew boy, this Hebrew kid that was in prison, and this cupbearer looks at, I don't know how he interrupts, Pharaoh was like, ah, Pharaoh, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you this, but I know a guy. And they go to prison, they pulled Joseph out of the dungeon, and they clean him up, they shave him, they dress him up like an Egyptian, even though he's a Hebrew, that might be insulting in the presence of an Egyptian Pharaoh, so they dress him up like an Egyptian, and he goes in before him, and Pharaoh says something like this, hey, young man, I've been told that the gods favor you, and you have the ability to interpret my dream. And Joseph replies with something rather disconcerting and shocking at first. And he kind of says like this, nah, what you heard was wrong. Wait, what? You don't say that to the Pharaoh. Are you kidding me? And Joseph goes on. He doesn't stop. He's like, listen, I can't tell you what your dream is about. What you heard was wrong. But my God can do that. Now, this was a big statement, because once again, Joseph is sitting here and he's saying, listen, it may seem like God has abandoned me, but I'm going to live like he's still with me. And I'm going to tell the king and the God of this world right now, that everybody views as the God of this world, that he is wrong and he ain't the king. This is crazy, crazy, ridiculous in this moment. And everybody in the room's gasping that Joseph, this Hebrew young man, has the audacity to talk this way to a man who views himself as God. See, Joseph's words were basically communicating this. Listen, Pharaoh, there is only one great God. Matter of fact, you're accountable to him as well. And as you might expect, palace guards are probably reaching for their swords like, dude, this guy's done. Slave in prison? Seriously, who talks this way to our king? But desperately needing to know about his dream, Pharaoh stops him and he asks Joseph, and Joseph replies and he says, this is what your dream means. The next 7 years are going to be years of unbelievable abundance and wealth and prosperity in your land. And then the next 7 years, they'll be filled with famine, with death, with pestilence like you've never, ever seen before, Pharaoh. And then Joseph, I love Joseph, he does the absolute unthinkable. He doesn't just stop with the interpretation of Pharaoh's dream. He goes ahead and tells Pharaoh what he thinks he ought to do. I love this. Something like this. So here's what I think you should do, Pharaoh. You should save up, store up while it's great. I'm serious. Store it all up during the next 7 years so when you will have everything that you and your people need. And here's something you probably weren't thinking about, Pharaoh, all right? But you'll have everything else that everybody else in the land needs too. And here's the best part, Pharaoh. Here's the best part. They will have to come to you. Submit to you, surrender to you, because you and you alone will have what they need. And then you'll have leverage on everybody else around you. That's what you ought to do. And you're going to become greater than you already are, Pharaoh. So you're going to need this. You're going to need somebody. I don't know who that is because I don't know your kingdom. I've been spending the last several years in prison. But you're going to need somebody who absolutely lives and breathes this plan and this strategy every single day of their lives for the next 7 years so you're prepared. That's what I think you ought to do. And then Pharaoh does something absolutely ridiculous. He names Joseph on the spot, the prime minister. He's like, oh yeah, you're the man. You're the man over all of Egypt. I am at the top and you are number two. Right there, and everybody's got to be thinking, wait, what? Haven't we just met this kid? It's like 15 minutes that he's been in your court, and you're going to name him the number two? And Pharaoh replies, can we find anybody wiser? Can we find anybody greater with wisdom and knowledge of wealth like this man? Nobody says anything. Didn't think so. He's in charge. So Joseph goes to work and everything is happening just as Joseph says, abundance, wealth, prosperity, and Joseph is just storing for 7 years. And then on January 1st of the 8th year, just as Joseph said, as my young son Caleb would do, I'm done. It's all over. It ends. It comes to a screeching halt and everything is fallen into place. Joseph has administrated the distribution of grain to all of Egypt. Word gets out to the surrounding kingdoms, and the surrounding lands start coming to Egypt, having to submit to Egypt. If Egypt wasn't already great, they are now at the top of the food chain because of Joseph. And then something interesting happens. Two years into the famine, the original family of Joseph, they run out of food too. And they have no choice but to go to Egypt and to buy food. And you probably know the story. Joseph's 10 older brothers, you know those guys? 10 older brothers. They have to go before the distributor of the food. Who is who? To arrange a sale for help and assistance. And here's what the Bible says happened. Genesis chapter 42. 5-7. It says, so Israel's, that's another name for Jacob. God must have changed his name. That's the big daddy. You know who I'm talking about, right? Y'all still tracking, right? That's Joseph's daddy. So Israel's sons, the older 10 brothers of Joseph, were among those who went to buy grain, for there was a famine in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all of its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him. Now, I didn't tell you about this. You've maybe heard it in another story or another series, but Joseph had a dream that one day all of his brothers would bow down to him. So far, I'm thinking whatever Joseph interprets a dream to be, I think you ought to pay attention. I don't know about you. They all bowed down to him with their faces to the ground, and as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. They didn't recognize him. Why? Because he's an Egyptian now. You don't raise to number two in Egypt and keep your Hebrew colors. They have made him Egyptian. They do not even know what he is, man. He's all painted up in that Egyptian stuff. He's got that little whoop whoop ponytail thing. You know what I'm talking about? They don't even know him. But he recognizes them in that moment. Now, folks, at this time, Joseph is about 39 years old. It's been 22 years since he's seen his brothers. You got to believe that the memories start flooding his brain at this time. And you got to believe that he most likely recalls the last time that he saw them in the bottom of a well, tied up like a pig, hearing their laughter as they're eating outside, making fun and mocking their brother. This is the last time that he's heard their voices. He remembers the smiles and the laughs as they sell him into slavery. And now, what? All 10 of them bowing down before him with their fate and their destiny now in his hands. But Joseph also remembers something else. He remembers a scene back in his history. He remembers a story that precedes when his brothers did all this to him. He recalls and he recounts this story from his childhood that was probably repeated time and time and time again to him and his brothers. And this is when Joseph connects the dots. And we reach a part of the story that somehow never gets told in connection with this. And we need to rewind and we need to go back. Is it all right if I tell you a little bit more story? Okay. Remember that Abraham gives birth to Isaac, and then there's Esau and Jacob. Everybody with me? We're back to Esau and Jacob. When Esau and Jacob were maybe like teenagers, they were very much different. Esau was just the man's man. He was a woodsman. He was a hunter. He loved hunting. He loved fishing. He was just a man's man. And Jacob was just a little bit different. Jacob was an unbelievable cook. They just had different sets of skills and interests. And the Bible tells us that one day when these two brothers were teenagers, Esau's been out on a hunt for like several days, and he comes back, and being a man's man, he's like, feed me right now. He's just unbelievably hungry, and Jacob has just cooked one of his unbelievable meals, and Esau smells it. He wants some of it, so he says something like this, dude, give me some of your stew, little bro. I need it now. And then he says what all of our kids have said to us before when they're starving. I'm starving too. Only the moms replied to that, right? I'm starving to death. Really? And this is what Esau's like, I'm going to die if I don't eat something. Give it to me, little bro. Give it to me. Now, this is a rare moment for a little brother, guys. I'm a little brother. I don't know if you're a younger sibling, but this is an interesting moment for a younger sibling. You probably know there's not a lot of opportunity growing up when you're the youngest to leverage anything against your older siblings. So Jacob thinks to himself what any younger brother would think, what can I get out of this? So Jacob starts the bidding. He starts the bidding about as high as you can think. And it's probably something like this. I'm going to shoot for the moon. You know what I'm saying? And we'll just work our way down and see where we end up. But this is where I'm going to start. And he starts the bidding off way, way up here. And he says this, I'll give you some of this stew, big bro. But you have to give me your birthright. Now remember, I just told you how big of a deal a birthright is. It's like huge in this day and age. Joseph's like, he'll never take this up. Not Joseph. Jacob's like, he'll never take me up on this. And Esau, remember, double portion, double wealth, automatic patriarch of the family. Esau, a teenager, frontal lobe, probably still not developed. So hungry that he thinks he's going to die. It's all about him right now. Deal. Shakes his hand. And he trades his birthright for a bowl of stew. And the Bible says that Esau despised his birthright. He ate the stew was gone, but so was the most valuable thing that he had. Gone. Let's keep walking. A little time goes by. Father Isaac is very, very old at this time. He's starting to lose his eyesight. And it's now time that his children go before him, and he gives them the blessing for each of them. Now, back in this day and age, you have to understand, this was a legally binding ceremony. What the father said once could not be retracted. It was a done deal. It was a legally binding ceremony. He was going to tell everybody what was theirs. And part of the blessing for Esau at this point in time, because he's the oldest, would be that Isaac would lay hands on Esau and give him in this moment the power of the patriarch. But Jacob, with the help of his mama, because he was a little bit of a mama's boy, he liked to cook, you know what I'm saying? He sneaks in before Esau into a dark room in front of Isaac. He covers his arms full of fur, animal fur, because I guess Esau was just this hairy little dude. He lowers his voice to try to sound like Esau. Isaac's a little confused, says, "You don't sound like him." He's like,
I am your son Esau.
Jacob swears,
"I am him."
And Jacob steals the blessing from Esau. Again, isn't this just a phenomenal biblical family example? So a little while later, Esau comes in. I don't know where he is. Esau, he's just that boy in your house that you're like, where is Esau? Your dad's giving blessings. Where are you at? Dude, I got to kill a couple more squirrels, and I'll be back. You know what I'm saying?
I'll trade my birthright for stew.
He's just not all there. But Jacob swears. So Esau comes in. Isaac's even more confused because he's like, I'm your son Esau. He's like, I'm sorry, son. I don't know who it was that just came in before you. But I already gave my blessing to whoever it was. And you know the rules. I can only do this once. And so you would naturally believe and know Esau is furious. He's like, are you kidding me? I was joking that day. It's not yours, and you took it to another level. He is ticked off with his little bro, Jacob, because Jacob has just stole what was rightfully his, and there's now nothing that he can do about it. Genesis 27:41 tells us this. Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing that the father had given him. He said to himself, the days of mourning of my father are near. Then, when he dies, I am going to kill my brother. Again, if you've ever thought about killing a sibling, you need counseling. In other words, as soon as my pops dies, I'm going to kill my little bro. And when I do, the birthright comes back to me because I will never bow down to my younger brother. Is it all starting to make sense? Let's keep walking. Word of Esau's fury gets to Jacob, something like this. You have until your father dies. So Jacob does what any younger brother does. He runs after he punched his brother in the face. He bolts and he leaves the country. And during his time away, guess what? He lives with his uncle, Laban, his future father-in-law. During that time, he marries a girl named Leah. You heard about her, the younger sister. Then later, he marries a girl named Rachel, the older sister, his favorite wife. Starting to make sense? So Leah gives birth to several boys. That's his first wife. Not his favorite, his second wife is his favorite. She gives birth to a couple boys. During this time, Rachel cannot get pregnant. So Leah, which is customary, gives her handmaiden to Jacob, and he has another couple boys. Rachel's really getting frustrated at this point in time and says, we need to have children together. So she gives her handservant to Jacob. They have a couple boys. Dude, it's getting crazy. It's like every time Jacob comes home, there's another woman waiting for him. You know what I'm saying? It's nuts. But finally, Rachel gets pregnant and delivers another son, and his name is, stay with me. So by the time that it's close to being over, we've got four women, and at this time in our story, we've got 11 sons. All of this over the course of about 20 years. Now, during this time, Jacob becomes very, very wealthy and prosperous. So prosperous that his extended family, Laban's boys, I don't know who it is, they come to him, his daughter-in-law's daddy, and they come to him and says, there's just too many of you. You need to leave this land. Laban's also become jealous because he thinks that Jacob's kind of undermined him and stolen some of his land and his property. So he's like, you need to get out of here. So after like 20 years, Jacob leaves. He leaves. Packs up his family, big family heritage so far, 11 boys, and all of his wealth. And finally, as they're wandering, the Lord speaks to Jacob and he says this. Genesis 31:3. He says, go back to the land of your fathers. Now guys, that would be the land of Abraham. That would be the land of Isaac. And that would be the land of Esau. Go back to your father's lands and to your relatives. And I will be with you, he says. Jacob's got to be thinking at this conversation with God, you had better be with me, God. Because if Esau is the same person that I left 20 years ago, not only is he going to kill me, but he's going to kill all my sons, any heritage that I have. He's going to take my wives as his wives, and he's going to take all my possessions. Time out, just again, real quick. Remember here, folks, these are stories. These are stories. Esau, Jacob, birthright, stolen birthright, that all of Jacob's wives, Leah, both handmaidens, Rachel, and all of Jacob's sons, all 11 of them, they grew up here, and you've heard stories from your parents about their childhood. They've grown up hearing about these stories, so they understood these things. So you can just imagine when Jacob comes back to his family and says, we're going home, his sons are replying, Dad, you mean we're going back to see Uncle Esau? Yes. Dad, you mean the same Uncle Esau that you told us wants to kill you? Yeah, the same Uncle Esau. So Jacob does what the Lord tells him. He packs up everything and they all begin to head back home. Meanwhile, Esau hears that they are coming back. And here's how the story continues in 33, verse 1. Jacob looked up in the distance and he saw there was Esau, coming with his 400 men. Not 400 people. 400 men, not 400, I brought the wives and kids so all the cousins could play together, 400 men. So Jacob knows what's about ready to happen. And it's too late to do anything else. He's got to be obedient to what God says. So in Genesis 33, it goes on. He says this. He divided up his children among Leah, his first wife, Rachel, his favorite wife, and the two female servants, the baby mamas of a few of the other boys. And watch what happens next. He put the female servants up in the front, along with their children. Leah, his first wife, and her children next. And of course, his second wife, Rachel, he puts in the back. And listen to what this says. It says, and Rachel and Joseph, apparently Benji's not been born yet, Rachel and Joseph in the back. And when you first read this, you may not have caught it. I didn't actually catch it right at first. I had to read it a few times. But after reading it, I found it interesting that Joseph is the only son named. As if there's some big things in store for this guy. Only son named by name. Let's keep reading. Verse 3, he himself went out. So he puts them all in this order. And then he goes out and he starts bowing down. We've seen that before, haven't we? Bowing down to the ground 7 times as he approaches his brother. Now get this, folks. Here is Jacob. He's finally coming home and he's bringing with him this small caravan full of fortune, full of wealth, with a rich family heritage. All right, 4 wives, 11 boys. They're all coming forward, unmanned, unarmed, perfect targets for a small army of about 400 men. And the family just watches. They just watch as the patriarch, Jacob, their patriarch, walks out before them every couple steps, bowing down. Every couple steps, bowing down before his long-lost brother. And as Jacob's family earnestly watches this unfold, they watch as he continues to bow down, catches, bow down before a man over and over, all the while knowing that their destiny, Their future hinges before a man that they do not know. Are you seeing the similarities in our stories? A man that their master, Jacob, has not seen in over 20 years. It's so eerily familiar to 10 brothers bowing down to a man that they haven't seen for 22 years, who now holds their destiny in his hands. And as he gets closer to Esau, the writer of Genesis says this: Esau ran out to meet Jacob, and he embraces him. He threw his arms around his neck, and he kisses him. And they wept. And then, because it was there for everybody to see, Esau looked up and he saw the women and children behind him. And he said, "Who are these with you?" he asked. Jacob answered, "These are the children that God has graciously given your servant." Then the female servants and their children approached and they bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came forward and they bowed down to Uncle Esau. And last came, once again, he names him by name, Joseph and Rachel. And they too bowed down. Now guys, again, you got to remember, this is something huge. This was a story that Joseph grew up and heard all of his life. His father, Jacob, had most likely told his boys around a campfire long one day after one day, over and over, and one that he himself had witnessed himself, Joseph had witnessed. It was the day that Uncle Esau spared his daddy's life. I hope you're getting this. I hope you're understanding this. He'd heard this story. His dad probably said, "Joseph, that was the day. Do you remember? That was the day that your Uncle Esau spared my life. He spared your life, and he spared your mother's life too." Something like this: "Joseph, you know how the story goes, son. I've told you this over and over. I don't know how many times. You know what your father deserved. You know that he deserved this. I was deceitful. I was filled with trickery. I stole this from my brother. Anything that Esau chose for me, I deserved it. But on that day, there was reconciliation. Nobody expected it, that no one deserved. And Joseph, that's why you're alive today." Now back to our original narrative. I'm almost done. Here we are, back to Joseph with 10 brothers bowing down. Some 30 plus years later from the last point that we just left. 22 years later from when all the injustice got thrown in a pit for Joseph. And there lay before Joseph all of his older brothers with their faces buried in the ground, bowing down. And Joseph holds the power. He holds the power of life and death in his hands for these guys. But Joseph connected the dots. And he chooses to do for these 10 guys what he saw his Uncle Esau do for him. I get chills. He chooses in a moment of crisis. Of course it's a moment of crisis. He chooses in a moment of extraordinarily conflicting emotions. Joseph chooses to do what he saw was done for him. He chooses to do what he grew up hearing over and over and over again, what was done for him, what the story was all about. And he extends mercy to brothers who deserved no mercy. And you probably heard how that story ended up, but just real quick, once that his 10 brothers find out who Joseph really is, they feel very much like their father did when he was before Esau. They feared for their lives. But there was a moment in this story, you can go read it, verify it, it's in there, that it says that all the brothers come together in this one big family moment, and they weep together. Much like Jacob and Esau did that one day. And Joseph said, as he remembered that story and connected the dots, and he said this: "You may have intended it for evil, but God has intended it for good. And all the while, guys, all the while, you know what? I just chose to live. That God was with me. Even though by all appearances it looked as if he had abandoned me. And he restores a broken relationship. He provides the need for the family. And the moral of this story is this. Please don't miss this, folks. What your grandchildren, what your nieces, and what your nephews see you do in the moments of crisis will lay the groundwork for what they do in future times of crisis too. They will most likely forget everything that you say to them. But they will never forget what you do. What you do when it's most difficult, I'm telling you, it will echo into your next generation. And you have got to grab a hold of this. When you think, and you did in that moment, you ran away, you thought that was the right thing to do, you thought that quitting in that stressful moment was the right thing to do, when you thought, I'm just going to stop paying my debts, and I'm going to declare this and that, and we're going to just continue to get ourselves in financial crisis, what they see you do because it seems like the easier thing to do, I'm telling you, folks, you got to get this. Your kids are watching you. They are always watching you every moment of every day, especially in the crisis moments. And they most likely won't remember what you say, but they will always remember what you do. Let's stand to our feet. Don't cut me off. Please don't leave. A couple more things to say. I leave you with this thought today. Dads, if you're out there, I want you to listen to this. I want to ask you, what if your sons are taking their cues from what you do? What if you are the future role model in how they will treat your future daughter-in-law? Moms, what if your daughters are taking their cues from what you do? What if? What if you are their future role model in how they will submit and respect your future son-in-law? Parents, what if how you parent is the future role model in how your kids will raise your future grandchildren? What if they take their cues from you? What if they take their cues from you? Let's all bow our heads as we get ready to sing a song. Seriously, folks, what if they take their cue from you? Because here's what I know. The odds are they will. And the bottom line is this today. Actions, they don't merely speak louder than words. Sometimes they echo into the next generation. And that means perhaps you have a greater opportunity than you have ever imagined. And that also means this, that you can make a decision now. You can respond to a temptation now. You can manage your money now. You can respond to a relational crisis now in such a way that apparently it will reverberate into your next generation, into your future generation. And here's all I'm going to leave you with. And what if what we're saying is true today? What if what we're saying is true today? What would you need to do to change? What in your life, what's that one thing that you need to do to change? If what we're saying is true, what needs to change? And then I'll leave you with this. If what we're saying today is true, I would ask you this. Why in the world would you not change? Why would you be okay with just leaving things as is? Why wouldn't you change? Let me pray for us. We'll sing a song. Jesus, thanks for being an amazing God. I pray that you would move mightily in people's lives. I pray that you would reveal to them what it is specifically that might need to change, that they can do differently, act accordingly in front of their children, that it echoes into their future generation. Thank you for this series, Lord. I pray that it spoke to somebody's life. I pray that you move mightily in your Son's precious and holy, holy, holy name. Amen.